210 on WGN. It's been a busy week for a lot of folks, and one of those people is Mike Leonard. Mike, we have bothered you so much on WGN radio this week. We appreciate your time, as always.
John, never bother. You know, it's such a nasty day out. It just brightens my day, John, just to be on with you.
Oh, I appreciate that. You're not only going to hear Mike here, but he was on the Mincing Rascals podcast, which posted on Wednesday, and we air some of that tonight at 8 on WGN Radio. You'll get to hear Mike's reactions to the arraignment or the charges that broke in the middle of the week. I have a general question for you, Mike, and it's aimed at bringing down my blood pressure and our listeners' blood pressure. Okay, you ready?
Sure, let's try it.
Is the Justice Department, the system of justice we have in this country, the Constitution, etc., is it up for the challenge of what this next year could potentially bring?
I think so. I mean, obviously, we're throwing a lot at the system, at the public at one time, with all these, you know, multiple cases against one man. So I think it's going to be, unfortunately, you know, media feeding frenzy and a talking point that we're not going to be able to get away from. But I don't see why the system can't handle it. I mean, first of all, they're going to have to do something in terms of the timing of the various trials. Probably, in my view, none of them are likely to really happen before the election, even though right now, that appears to be a possibility, even with certain dates set. Mm-hmm. But I don't think those dates are realistic. So maybe that gives people a little more comfort. That's really not going to happen before the election, which I think probably would be a good thing.
You think it would be a good thing if it didn't happen before the election or if it did happen before the election?
I think it'd be a good thing if it didn't happen before the election, just sort of have it off in the distance. I guess from a voter perspective, maybe people would say that's a bad thing because they want to know if there's a conviction or not. But I think it'd be a good thing in terms of letting everybody prepare for the cases appropriately and kind of put it off in the distance. But I guess a lot of people might disagree with that philosophy.
I don't think there's a right answer, Mike, because I think a lot of people would want to know what the outcome is before they vote, perhaps. I don't know how many people's opinions are swayable at this point, but recent polling shows it's a lot. A lot of people are just like, I don't know who I'm going to vote for or anyone. And there is some polling out there that shows that convictions could sway people one way, or maybe on the same side, a not guilty verdict could sway someone the other way. But at the same time, you want every defendant, the former president or yourself or anybody, to be afforded the time that they need to mount a defense. That's like a given part of our justice system. So this is hard.
Yeah, and we had this discussion, you know, John Williams on the Mincing Rascals raised the prospect of, hey, you know, why can't these cases go to trial more quickly? And the common sense answer is that the government is, you know, miles ahead of the defense because they have the opportunity to develop a case for months or years and then all of a sudden file the charges and then give the defense counsel and the client, you know, literally hundreds of thousands to millions of pages of documents, which many of which are keenly relevant. And all of these cases present some novel legal issues, which will certainly be the subject of motion practice before there's ever a trial. So, you know, to think that these cases should go to trial in 2024 is not realistic, and it's not consistent with other cases. You know, if we had a case that was charged today, the expectation wouldn't be that with certainty it's going to go forward within 1 year and be tried. That's rarely, if ever, happens in the federal system. So, and I know some of these cases are state court cases, but the same logic applies.
Yeah.
You have an investigation which is way ahead of the defense, and then you give them all the stuff and say, hey, let's set a date. And that's just really not fair to anybody, especially the defendant.
I know a lot of people were, obviously some people are really upset about the charges brought, and a lot of people almost had like this celebratory popping champagne feel to it, which I kind of felt weird about because I'm worried about where this goes. And maybe it's because I should stop just playing scenarios out of my head. But if the former president is elected president again, duly elected, and has these charges looming over him, there's the thought about, does he pardon himself? Does he have an attorney general dismiss the cases? Is there political retribution? I feel like no matter which side you're on, it should be a sad day in the country when the former president is indicted. I don't know how you feel on that, Mike.
Yeah, no, and I understand that sentiment. I mean, the fact that people are celebrating their former president's charge of the crime, you know, does seem unusual in some respects in that You know, it's not something we really want to have to happen. But I do understand the mentality of a lot of people, like, hey, in many people's minds, these are serious issues. They merit charges. And if charges are merited, then they should be filed regardless of the identity of the defendant. And, of course, a lot of people would say that the system works best when it goes against people who are of the most powerful, right?
Right.
And therefore, you know, there shouldn't be this unequal justice system. So we could probably talk about it all day, but I think it makes everybody uneasy regardless. You know, I mean, I don't think anyone feels calm and certain about anything, particularly in light of the number of cases and the scenarios, which you said, you know, because certainly if he becomes president, he'll certainly try those techniques and it'll be up to the court to decide whether they're legitimate, whether he can really pardon himself. So there's a lot ahead of us in 2024, that's for certain.
Yeah, and this third one obviously was about something we all saw play out, right? So I get that this third one about January 6th, or really about what led up to it more so than on that day, has a lot of people like emotionally charged. And I, for one, watched that January 6th as it played out. We all did, right? And I had a visceral reaction to it, a fear and a anger that I hadn't had about something rather political ever, and oh my God. So I guess I can see the other side of it when you're like, finally, a lot of people, the people that they think was responsible for this and now has been charged for what ended up happening, or the lead up to it. I guess I get the emotional reaction to it, but it just still does make me feel a little sad. Hey, Mike, I'm going to take a phone call. You ready to get one?
Absolutely. Let's bring it on, John.
All right. This is Mike Leonard, and now we got Mike on the line. Hey, Mike.
Hey, guys. First of all, I don't think that Trump and what he did, I don't think he was involved in, you know, he might have been the mastermind of January 6th and that, but I don't think he was involved in what the chaos was involved.
Right, right.
Here's the thing I wanted to talk about the most is, as a voter, I do believe that he was trying to take away a voting right or let my vote count. And this is something that I would like to see televised going forward. I think both sides, I heard the lawyer for Trump the other day saying, yeah, let's let the people, you know, be the judge. And I think that would take a lot of the chaos that Trump might want to bring to his social media and this and try to spin things. People can see it for themselves then when it's on TV.
I think a lot of people agree with you, Mike, and we appreciate the phone call. And want Leonard's opinion on this, too, because it seems like, at least what they're saying, it seems like both sides want this on TV. Who's all that ultimately up to? Because what, the current rule is no federal court cases are ever on television?
Correct. Yeah, the general rule across the country is federal court cases are never televised, but I think Mike makes a fantastic point. I mean, we have the most important case literally in our history, and why would we not let the public see that? You know, if we can see political debate and discussion within the House of Representatives, we can't see the most important trial in history with our former president. And I think Mike makes a good point. It'd be good for people to actually see what the evidence is, what the testimony is, and not be speculating about what the evidence and testimony is, or giving characterizations of it. And I think Mike made a good point. I presume he was saying that, you know, the charges are in part because, you know, President Trump's accused of attempting to disenfranchise voters.
Right.
And I think a lot of people, you know, and it's hard to sit down and read an indictment, especially a 40-page one. And just when you tell someone it's a 40-page indictment, their probably eyes are going to glaze over. They're not going to read it. And it was difficult for me to get through the whole thing myself, candidly, but you kind of make yourself do it because of, all the questions that are going to come up. But one of the core allegations in the complaint, I think Mike is referring to, is this idea that the former president behind the scenes, you know, working or attempting to work with very top-level people, including Republicans, you know, much of the evidence cited in the indictment is about Republicans, as well as Democrats, but attempted to try to put forth fake electors in other states, you know, to try to fake a certification of the election in his favor, which, you know, regardless of where you're on the political scheme, you can see why that might be something that someone might want to prosecute. So, but I think there's so much talk around the indictment and what it really says and what the motivations are. I think it'd be a wonderful thing for everybody to get to watch this trial. I think it'd be a great thing for our system and for our country, and just, you know, allow people to focus on what the evidence is rather than what we all say it is. You know what I mean?
Right. Someone texted in that it's illegal to televise federal court. Is it illegal, or is it just that's the practice it's been and it's up to someone to change it or not?
That's a good question. I don't know that there's actually a federal law on the books that says you can't, but they don't, and that is the rule, right? It could easily be amended. You know, courts in any jurisdiction can essentially have broad discretion to, you know, make rules that govern their own procedures. So I don't know that there's actual federal law that says it can't happen, but generally, procedurally, that's the rule in every jurisdiction in the country. So I'm probably missing whatever that law is, but I don't doubt that's possible.
Mm-hmm.
But there has never been a federal criminal trial that's been on TV, but it should be. Why not? You know, there's no reason not to.
I
can't think of a reason why you would say don't do it. I mean, if you can televise the OJ trial 30 years ago, you can certainly televise the Trump trial, which is of much more public significance.
I mean, at least they have the audio stream of the Supreme Court, right? At least provide something like that.
Yeah. I mean, look, the amazing thing is, you know, in our federal courts, you know, obviously we have the trial court level, which is the district court where President Trump will be tried. And then we have the appellate court levels in Chicago. We have the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. When we do arguments before the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, they're not televised, but immediately, and I think maybe even live streamed, you can listen to the entire thing, you know, within either minutes after you're done or maybe even while you're doing it. So what's the difference? You know, I don't see any basis, any legitimate basis not to televise it. I mean, if you go back in history, the idea was always, well, it'll impact how the proceedings are held. It'll impact the jury. It'll impact the attorneys. I think we're well beyond that,
yeah.
Especially in light of the fact that we've been televising trials from various states for literally decades now.
Right, and obviously the jury is going to have to make their decision, and I appreciate maybe anonymity, not showing them, et cetera, et cetera. But in essence, we're all the jury in this sort of case, because ultimately we have to make a decision as a country who we're going to vote for, right? So I think that plays a part in it. But anyways, I did want to ask, not to put you on the spot, Mike, but I don't know if you're up to speed or saw what kind of played out late last night and into this morning, and that has to do with Trump Social's post. Actually, tell you what, Mike, why don't I take a break, give you a chance to read up on that if you haven't, and then we'll tackle the latest developments in that case. And then, yes, we are going to move on from this subject and talk about other issues that Mike wants to jump on, and we'll have your calls too, 312-981-7200. More Let's Get Legal after this on WGN. Okie dokie, it's Let's Get Legal. We're powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Mike Leonard from Leonard Trial Lawyers joining us. Okay, so the Justice Department has asked a federal judge overseeing the criminal case against the former president to step in after Trump posted online. Basically, it seemed to promise revenge on anyone who, quote, goes after him. And prosecutors then say, hey, I want a protective order concerning evidence in the case. And I think the judge responded that they want the defense to reply by Monday. They've asked for an extension. Are these typical things that happen before trials, or is this out of the ordinary, Mike?
Very much out of the ordinary. So in any federal case, just like in a lot of state court cases, there's going to be an order that says, hey, look, defendant, you can't communicate with other defendants. You can't communicate with witnesses, et cetera, et cetera. The Trump situation gets a little more difficult because some of the people that are potential witnesses are people that still work for him. So the judge would admonish him, you know, you can't talk to witnesses about the case. And there's also other principles embedded in our system that attorneys and parties cannot make attempts to influence the jury, which is difficult to enforce when you have a political candidate out there, you know, talking about how cases are being used as a political motivation against him. So that's impossible to stop. But when you get to the level of specificity that he put in a social media post, essentially you could read it as a threat, like, hey, the people who are prosecuting me or the people who participate in the process to try to convict me, I'm coming after them. That's a little more direct. So
yeah,
certainly what's going to happen, there'll be briefing on this. The judge is going to try to rein him in, which is difficult, you know, because on one hand, he has a lot of rights in terms of what he can say as a politician out there on stump. But there is a case here, and of course he's going to be treated in some respects like other defendants. So clearly the judge is going to try to come up with some more specific parameters and probably admonish him that, you know, that type of post won't be allowed as inappropriate. But it's a fine line here because you got a political candidate. But that looked like more of an outward threat, and I could see why the judge is going to take that more seriously. But, yeah, no, this type of thing does not happen often, if ever, in federal criminal cases. It's highly unusual, but it's because the defendant is who he is.
This judge and Judge Elaine Cannon in Florida, they have got, like, this Herculean task because a lot of people are going to call for Trump to be thrown in prison awaiting the trial if he keeps on messaging things like this. And, like, these judges want to appear and are trying to be as impartial as possible. I do not envy the position either one of those judges, one appointed by Trump, one appointed by President Obama, are in. They are both in difficult spots.
Oh, it's a very tough position. And no matter what, you know, you have the judge in Florida who was clearly a Republican, you know, appointee. And then you have the judge in the D.C. case who clearly is a Democratic appointee. You know, as we all know, federal court judges are appointed through a process that essentially has their senators recommend who the people are. They're always with, you know, their party. But they're going to be over such scrutiny because it doesn't matter. They're still humans. They're still judges. They're still trying to get it right. And they can't be biased, you know, obviously in one favor or the other because they'll take so much criticism. And let's face it, both of these judges, this will be remembered as part of their life's work. It'll be probably the first thing that's said in their, not only in their Wikipedia page, but everywhere. So,
yeah, right.
You know, they really have to be even-tempered, do everything they can to bend over backward to let the public know they're trying to be fair. And it's a difficult, difficult situation. There's no question about it.
Yeah. I wish both sides would just kind of chill out about it. I didn't like the immediate attacks that Judge Elaine Cannon got, even after she moved the trial date, which you and I talked about right afterwards, seemed fairly fair on its face and immediately was attacked by certain people. But we'll dive into this more, Mike.
Yeah, getting back to your point you made, John, is I think there's zero chance that President Trump is going to be detained before trial.
Right.
That's never going to happen, okay? However, certainly the judge is going to try to rein him in to the extent that's possible. And, you know, you can hold someone in contempt, right? You don't have to detain them. You can still hold them in contempt. You can have a monetary penalty. You can have other penalties. So clearly the judge is going to take this latest thing that looks like a threat seriously. But the idea that's been, you know, kind of thrown out there that maybe he'll be detained before trial, that's just ridiculous. It's never going to happen.
For sure. All right, Mike Leonard, I'm going to put you on hold here. You don't mind sticking around a little longer, right?
Would love to, John.
We're going to pivot off the Trump stuff. I'm done with the Trump stuff for the week. That's enough. We're going to talk about some cool stuff you were doing at Northwestern, I believe, and some other things that Mike Leonard's working on. We'll take your questions, too. Anything, it could be Trump-related, it could be anything. Any questions? I mean, Mike offers a great opportunity here as a federal defense attorney, Leonard Trial Lawyers. He's been doing this for a long time, one of the most successful federal defense attorneys that the country's seen. So if you have any questions about how that process works or anything that happens at the court, now's the chance to answer. We got a half hour left. 312-981-7200 after the news on WGN. 237 on WGN. It's John Hanson. This is Let's Get Legal. We're powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. We're with you till 3 o'clock. Mike Leonard from Leonard Trial Lawyers is here with us today. And Mike, you were doing something cool this week, weren't you?
Yeah, it was an interesting week, John. I was on trial, but I wasn't. So it was a joint program through Tel Aviv University in Israel and Northwestern Pritzker School of Law. And essentially what they offer is a Master of Laws program for lawyers in Israel. And they take, you know, two semesters of courses over there. Some of them are taught by Northwestern professors who go over there. And then they come here in the summer and they do about 5 weeks intensive here. You know, each week is a different subject area, like a substantive subject area, like, you know, it could be environmental law or international regulation or whatever. But the last week is devoted to trial practice. So they bring in people like me and other practicing lawyers, and we're essentially putting on a trial practice program for these lawyers for the whole week. They're doing all the work. You know, they're given a problem, much like you do this in law school, a regular law school, where you give them a case and a set of materials about the case, all the witness statements, all the evidence, et cetera. And then, you know, each day for the training or instruction, you know, the lawyers like myself would give a mock opening statement or a mock closing argument or a mock direct examination. And then we break down into small groups, and the lawyers who are the students, you know, would work on the craft that we had discussed that day. And ultimately, at the end of the week, put on the mock trial. So really fascinating, you know, number one, working with lawyers from another country, just a really talented group of people from all walks of the law over there. And just to get, you know, trying to have them hone their skills and learn our trial practices, which is tough to do in a week, but it's very intense. But I think it's probably one of the most favorite classes they have. It's as opposed to the lecture system.
Yeah. So it's a lawyer exchange program.
Yeah. Well, they're already lawyers. They're already admitted lawyers in Israel. Many of them practicing for anywhere from a few years to decades. And so then they're getting another degree. Essentially, they're getting like a master of law through the university over there jointly with Northwestern. And so it's kind of a nice credential to get. And so, you know, there are already people who are practicing in different areas of law over there, and they're getting, you know, a real taste of our system.
Okay. That's interesting stuff, Mike. Hey, we've got a question on the phone line. You ready to take one?
Absolutely.
Tom's in the old Irving Park neighborhood, great area in Chicago. Tom, you're on WGN. What's your question?
Yeah, I had a question. Since he's a federal defense attorney, I wanted to know what he thought about these mailmen in our neighborhood who are getting robbed and then shot.
Yeah.
So these punks are robbing, you know, our neighborhood mailmen, and after they give up the keys that they want, you know, their cell phone money, these punks are shooting them.
Yeah, I did see those
videos.
What
do you think the likelihood is that they'll get charged under federal law?
That's an interesting question, Mike Leonard, huh?
Oh, well, number one, I mean, of course, you feel horrible about that. Any postwoman who's doing their job as hard as they work. I mean, we all know from any neighborhood you lived in your life, the hours that they put in and the sacrifices they make, to have them attacked is just ludicrous. And it seems like there should be more done to protect them in the neighborhoods. It's hard to believe that they're allowing this to happen, so to speak, but I guess it's obviously still tough to enforce. But the likelihood of getting charged federally is extremely high. If they're able to apprehend anybody, they'll for certain be charged federally.
Is it because they're a federal worker?
Yeah, because they're a federal worker, they're carrying out a federal function. You know, you can even have robbery cases in federal court, which are called Hobbs Act robberies, which are just the fact that they affect interstate commerce. So someone could rob a business, and it still could be charged as a federal robbery because the theory is it affects interstate commerce. So I've had defended those cases. Yeah, interestingly, in federal court, I haven't had to defend anybody who's been accused of an attack upon a post person. However, I have had cases where I've defended post people against federal charges. So, yeah, absolutely. If they're caught, and I'm sure they're working on these cases extremely hard, they usually have task force, and I'm sure it's getting a ton of attention from law enforcement. And when they're caught, you can guarantee they'll be charged federally.
Yeah, and that's what a thanks for the call, Tom. Did that answer your question?
You got it. Yeah, it does.
All right, cool.
And I just want to say, you know, I'm proud of the neighbors. They're all looking out for our mailmen.
Good.
We have a lot of off-duty police officers that are actually, you know, hanging back a block away, keeping an eye on the mailmen in the neighborhood. This is absolutely, it's got to stop.
It does. It's ridiculous. Number one, you shouldn't be robbing anyone, of course. And going after a federal official is insane. And also, what a tough job that already is. It's still a very important job in our society, and it's going to be hard to recruit people to do that job if in our city they are being robbed at and shot at. Tom, thanks for the call, okay?
You got it. Take care, guys.
All right, very good.
Yeah, and no doubt. I mean, and especially when you have attacks upon, you know, CPD or mail persons. I mean, it's you're really attacking the system, and you're really not only is it amazing that they could target these people who are doing what they can for the society, but the fact that they could, you know, get away with it for so long, it's troubling on a lot of different levels.
Yeah, for sure. All right, Mike, let's take a quick break. More with Mike Leonard, 312-981-7200 from Leonard Trial Lawyers. If you got any questions, let us know, 312-981-7200. More after this on WGN. 246 on WGN. Zaletsky Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. John Hansen here. Just take you for another 14 minutes till the top of the hour. Dave Plyer will be on afterwards. Mike Leonard joins us from Leonard Trial Lawyers, a frequent guest here on this program and elsewhere on WGN. Federal defense attorney, represents whistleblowers too. Earlier, Mike, I don't know if you heard, but I called you one of the nation's most successful federal defense attorneys.
You notice that I didn't interrupt you and say, no, that's not true?
I had your mic turned down, so you didn't even have the choice to do that. So
I'll take any compliment I can get, John. You know how us lawyers are.
Well, you get a lot of not guilty verdicts, which is pretty rare, huh?
It is. It's always tough to get them, and so gratifying. There's nothing quite like those words floating across the courtroom, you know, not guilty. So absolutely exciting every single time.
You mentioned mock trials and kind of what was going on with you guys and the lawyers from Israel. But you brought up in law school there's mock trials. What skills, I mean, is that simply just working through the motions for law students? What benefit does that have to prepare lawyers of the future?
Well, it's a huge benefit. So, you know, the bedrock of any law school who has a trial practice program is doing it kind of like the way I just described with these real lawyers. So really every law school in the country has some sort of mock trial program where you bring in lawyers from the community, or it might just be lawyers from the law school, and you're teaching them all the skills, you know, the skills of conducting a direct examination, to doing a cross-examination, to doing a closing argument, because, of course, in law school, these people have never done any of those things, don't know how to do it, don't understand how to do it or the techniques, and, you know, maybe have never even really actually been to a trial. And, you know, if you're a person who wants to be a trial lawyer and you're a law student, it usually ends up being one of your most, you know, satisfying and fun classes that you ever take, and probably the most practical, obviously, because you're getting taught by people who do this all the time. So it's a very effective way to teach. Of course, there's no substitute for getting in front of juries and actually trying cases, but you find that the preparation you have to put in for these mock trials is just like getting ready for a real trial. So I think the skills absolutely translate. You know, the thing I noticed this week is I had to present. So, John, I had to do, one day I had to do for the 20 lawyers a opening argument. And for one of the days I had to do a direct examination. You use fake witnesses and all that kind of stuff. So just getting ready for, you know, presenting in wasn't even a mock trial. It's just kind of how you do a mock trial. Mm-hmm. And presenting part of that for me. I was nervous about that. You know, I put a lot of time into just get ready to do the fake presentation of how you do something. So absolutely a great way to develop skills. And, of course, as you start to practice, you know, there's no substitute for real trials, but it's a great way to learn and a great way to teach.
When do you remember and do you still reminisce about your first federal trial experience, Mike?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I was lucky enough. I was under the tutelage of another lawyer, a longtime federal criminal lawyer in Chicago by the name of Ray Pajon, and he was sort of assigned as my mentor, so to speak, for my first federal criminal trial. And he was nice enough to really step back and let me do everything almost. I mean, he was obviously guiding me, talking to me throughout the whole process. And I've tried cases before, many civil cases and some state criminal cases by that time. We're talking 20 years ago. But it was absolutely fantastic, and I just loved every minute of it and just the opportunity to do it, because I'd spent at that point a number of years in federal court, largely in civil cases, and seeing these piles of evidence sitting on the tables and saying, I went in on that. So absolutely memorable, and I know this, I didn't win that first one.
I was just going to ask. I'm glad you offered, so I didn't have to ask there.
It was a tough one. It was a guy accused of essentially making money in his home, and with a lot of evidence against him, you know, had some sort of
printing the money
machine. Yeah. Literally making money in his house. And so, as you can imagine, it had a lot of challenges in defending the case. I think one of them at the beginning of the case was that the defendant insisted that he wasn't a sovereign citizen of the United States.
Oh, boy.
Even though he was.
Oh,
the court really could not. The court really could not exercise jurisdiction over him. So it presented a lot of challenges, which were memorable.
That's almost like, are you pranking the new kid? Is this for serious?
Yeah, I mean, you know, let's face it. Some cases you get are more difficult to defend than others.
Yeah.
You're always looking for your best chance of how you could win the case if it goes to a jury. And sometimes it's really a difficult task, especially in the federal court, because, as you know, the feds like to investigate and work up their cases for long periods of time before they ever charge anybody. So it always makes it a challenge.
So, and just to be clear, you couldn't argue that in court that he wasn't a sovereign citizen of the United States. That wasn't a defense you were able to use, right? Okay.
Yeah, no, that was what's called the jailhouse defense. So another funny thing that happens, I don't know if funny is the right word, but from time to time in different jurisdictions, different legal theories go through inmate populations. So at that time in our history in Chicago, that theory was kind of permeating through the federal jail in Chicago that, hey, you can say you're not really, the court doesn't have jurisdiction over you. It has no sovereignty over you. So it was a crazy thing that went through the jail and these guys trying to convince their lawyers to argue that to the court. So these things happen from time to time, John. It's an interesting world out there.
Yeah, sure is. Okay. Hey, I mean, they're doing their best to figure out a way out of it. Criminal appeal, you've got one this week. Those have got to be tough, right?
Yeah, so criminal appeals, you know, it's a different animal. You know, number one, you know, either it's a case you've tried yourself, and so you're very familiar with what the potential legal issues on appeal are, or you're hired after someone else has tried the case, and obviously not won, and you're trying to figure out, you know, you're kind of coming to it completely fresh, right, but completely cold. So you're doing everything you can to read everything from the record, from the trial court, and particularly, of course, the trial transcripts, and try to get up to speed. And it's more difficult to do when you didn't try the case yourself, because when you try the case yourself, you understand what were the key legal issues during that trial. And so what you're looking for is errors committed by the trial court, either in the rulings before the trial started or rulings in terms of what or was excluded at trial. And that's kind of what you're limited to, because the appellate court proceeding, just like in a civil case, it's not a do-over of the trial. They're not weighing the evidence and the credibility and saying, you know, we would have found this guy credible, or we would give more weight to this than that.
Well, we're losing Mike there a little bit. Why don't we just kind of get him off and get him back on again, change that cell signal. We're talking with Mike Leonard from Leonard Trial Lawyers about all things and criminal cases, and he's doing an appeals court. Let's see if it's any a little better now, Mike. Sorry about that. You were cutting out a little bit.
Any better?
Nope, not any better. Why don't we hang up and get a back gag? Thank you very much, Eli. 254 here on WGN. He's saying something important, and it's a question a lot of people have about the appeals process, how that sort of stuff works, and Mike's certainly an expert on that. And that could come to be something handy for all of us to remember, as you know, a lot of these big profile cases, whether we're talking about ones against former President Trump or other issues, there's a lot of appeals that go on involved in that, and it's something from a perspective that a defense lawyer, especially a federal defense lawyer like Mike Leonard, might be able to answer. Having trouble getting back on in here, too. We'll see if we can do that here before the end of the show. We got about 5 minutes left. My guess is that we will be able to do it. I did see an interesting story, just pivoting a little bit while I dance here and try and kill some time. Colorado has raised their gun law purchase, their law to purchase a gun up to the age of 21, and that will go into effect Monday. This is a Senate bill. It has several sweeping gun reform measures approved by Colorado and signed by the governor in the spring will prohibit people under the age of 21 from purchasing a gun, with the exceptions of active members of the U.S. Armed Forces. It'll be interesting to see if this one ends up getting challenged or not. Obviously, a lot of gun cases have started making their way up the federal courts as people feel like there is a Supreme Court that is much more willing to hear the pro-gun, pro-Second Amendment argument and rule in their favor. So again, Colorado saying that people under the age of 21 can't purchase a gun. We'll follow that one, too. We've got Mike Leonard back here on the line. Sorry, Mike, I had to tap dance for a minute there.
John, I thought it was just a technique by you. Either I was talking too much or I was boring you, and you just said, oh, I can't hear you anymore, Mike. Let's go to a commercial break.
No, I do that to my relatives, not to my guests. Okay. So, by the way, 847 just chimed in. John, my palms get sweaty and my heart races just hearing the description of being a trial lawyer. No way I could do that. So respect for you there. You were talking about the appeals process, how it's not a complete redo of the case or anything. But the burden of proof changes in appeals, right? Like at first, a jury has to decide beyond a reasonable doubt that you're guilty. But in an appeal, correct me if I'm wrong, the defendant has more of the burden, right?
Yeah, on appeal, you're really, it's tough. And, you know, statistically, you know, probably convictions are upheld in federal court in Chicago by the Seventh Circuit Appeals. Literally, I don't know, who knows, probably 90% or more. In state court, it's not that quite bad, but certainly the majority of them, maybe 70, 80%, those convictions are going to be upheld. So what you're arguing on appeal in a criminal case is the fact that the court committed some sort of legal error, meaning they might have instructed the jury improperly, they might have allowed evidence in that they shouldn't have, they excluded evidence that they that the jury should have heard, you know, that the prosecutor made an error in making an inflammatory argument during closing arguments. So you have to think of some way that the trial court got it wrong, either in a ruling or in the procedures that were employed by the trial. So it's difficult, but, you know, it's not unheard of to get a reversal or sometimes to get the court to send it back for a new trial. So, but yeah, it's certainly a challenge, and it's very different than trying a case. And ultimately, you get a three-judge panel that you step in front of and do an oral argument from. So that's its own fun circus.
Someone had a question for you about attorneys, and do most attorneys choose a specialization, or are a lot of them general practice attorneys? Is there a breakdown? I imagine most specialize, don't they?
Yeah, it's cool. There's still a lot of people that do a lot of different things. There's, you know, what's called a general practice attorney that might do anything from a will to a personal injury case to a contract, you know, all sorts of different things. And certainly that's certainly very common in the law, but I think more so in the last, you know, 10, 15 years is much more specialization. So someone might do exclusively representing companies in employment discrimination cases, or someone might exclusively handle class actions on behalf of plaintiffs, et cetera, et cetera. So the fun thing about being a trial lawyer is that if you have the interest, you can try a wide variety of cases, civil and criminal. But the tendency is for people to do exclusively criminal or exclusively civil. There's not a lot of people that do both just because they develop that specialization. And quite frankly, the interest, a lot of times, some criminal lawyers want no part of the civil trial process and the depositions and the years that it takes. So it kind of depends what your interests are.
All right, Mike, thanks for helping us through the show today and walking through a lot of these issues. Who should be reaching out to you, Mike?
John, people who are charged or being investigated for federal crimes or for state crimes. As we talked about, we try a lot of federal cases, and we also try a lot of state court criminal cases as well. And then on the civil side, we regularly represent whistleblowers who are blowing the whistle on either their employer or some other company. So thanks for having me on, John. You always give me the sweaty palms and the heartbeat, too. You know, the nerves coming out here.
Yeah, you should talk to your doctor about that. What's the phone number should reach you at, Mike?
312-380-6559.
All right, Leonard at TrialLawyers.com. Thanks, Mike. Have a good one. We'll talk soon, all right?
Hey, John. Appreciate it. Take care.
That's right. And that'll do it for Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Time for the news on WGN.